Welcome to Food for Thought, the place to explore, celebrate, and manifest a life motivated and defined by unconditional compassion and optimal wellness. My name is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau, and I'm your host. My work is dedicated to empowering people to live according to their own values of compassion and wellness. You can learn more about who I am and what I do by visiting joyfulvegan.com. Hi, everybody. Welcome. I am so glad to be here on this beautiful day. I feel like I've been starting every podcast by saying that because it is another gorgeous day here in Northern California. Thank you so much for listening. It's been wonderful to see all of you in different mediums. And for those who don't know, I've been doing daily broadcasts, live broadcasts on Periscope. And Periscope is, I feel like it's a medium that I had been waiting for because I love the directness, the immediacy of these live broadcasts where you can participate by asking questions, by sending your love, by sharing them right away. It's just so immediate and I love it. So join me over at Periscope. You could just find me at Joyful Vegan by searching for that on Periscope and I hope to see you over there. I've been doing them daily. And of course, it's lovely to be here as well. And thank you to everybody who is supporting this work because every bit of support you provide enables me to be basically producing all of this content in all of these different mediums. And it's really exciting to see because I get to see right away how it's affecting people and how it's changing people's lives. And it is. And thank you for your support in making this possible. Thank you to everybody who's supporting at every level, but thank you to Danielle Puller, who just became a $30 a month gold patron. Danielle has been a supporter for many years in many ways. She's been a friend for many years. She used to help me in my cooking classes, and I was really incredibly grateful when I saw her support come in. So thank you so much, Danielle. And we have a new $100 a month supporter in Ulrich. Ulrich, we haven't heard back from you. We've reached out to you to thank you and get you your gifts, but thank you so much for your support. Thank you to everyone who's making this possible. You can go to joyfulvegan.com and become a monthly or a one-time contributor today. And I want to thank a one-time contributor, Kelly Cayazzo. I think it would be Cayazzo. Kelly, I love that name. And Kelly made a very generous one-time $500 donation. And she wrote a beautiful email when I thanked her for her generous donation. She wrote, "Thank you, Colleen. I have been plant-based for about 2 years and vegan for a year and a half. It can be very hard when you're an ethical vegan and your extended family and all of your friends are not. To have your podcast helping me process all of my feelings and channel them appropriately so I can be an effective ambassador for animals and not a social outcast has been so helpful. I'm not alone. There are thousands of us who no longer feel alone because we have you. I'm also working to find and connect with other vegans nearby. Your podcast is so useful as I transition into animal activism. I'm currently working on lectures to give free presentations to high school classes, and you can find Kelly's blog at iamrunningthis.com. And I'm very excited to join this movement and use my education and classroom teaching experience for good. It's a pleasure to support you in the work you're doing, and thank you for all the thought you've put into building a knowledge base for those of us who need to make a difference and can benefit from your guidance. Best wishes, Kelly Cayazzo." Thank you so much, Kelly. As you know, I'm incredibly grateful and moved and touched. And thank you, everybody. You can support this work at joyfulvegan.com. Okay, just a couple quick announcements. I already mentioned the Periscope, so go find me at Periscope. I'm traveling a ton, so make sure you go to joyfulvegan.com/events. And at the end of this podcast, I'm going to tell you about a very special announcement that has to do with New Year's Eve 2016, I guess, bringing in 2016 from 2015. And I hope you can join me. So make sure you listen to the end of the podcast for that special announcement. I'm super excited about it. I will be in Chicago next week. I'm also speaking up in Santa Rosa in California. I will be out in Atlanta for the Atlanta Veg Fest. I will be in Portland for the Portland Veg Fest. This is Portland, Oregon, not Portland, Maine. And I will be at the Farm Sanctuary Thanksgiving event in New York in November. And I'll announce the special travel at the end of the podcast. And I hope you'll stick around for it. And by the way, just speaking of travel, I have to say this company called Squeeze Pod had sent me some of their little single-use natural toiletries. They're all vegan, of course. And I am kind of a travel pro, but I really did like these little guys. They're TSA approved, of course. They're TSA size, so you don't have to think about putting shampoo and lotion and conditioner in the small, you know, under 3 ounce bottles. They're little pods, and they have like shampoo and conditioner and lotion and shaving lotion and I just found them really convenient, and I appreciate SqueezePod for sending me some of these to just check out. So I just wanted to give them a little shout out and a thank you, and you can go to squeezepod.com for them. Well, I'm very excited about today's episode. I really, really enjoyed writing it. I can't say enjoyed completely in that there was pleasure all of the time because some of the things that I witnessed and saw and read about are very disturbing. But I feel very close to this subject because of my love of film and, of course, my love of animals. And I really love talking about these two topics together. And I was really happy to hear from so many of you who watched White God, the film, the Hungarian film I recommended in the last podcast episode about that film. And it sounds like those of you who watched it really enjoyed it as much as I did. And I'm so glad. And a lot of people said that they wouldn't have heard about the movie if it hadn't been for that podcast episode. So I invite all of you to listen to that episode if you haven't yet. And I, of course, invite you to watch that film called White God. As a companion episode, and frankly, it's going to be a couple episodes, today we're going to talk about the larger issue of animals in film, but it's only part one of two parts, maybe even more once I start writing the other episodes. Of course, we're going to continue exploring other forms of entertainment in which animals are used. A lot of people have asked me about zoos and circuses, and I know it's crazy. I mean, we've done this podcast for almost 10 years, and I don't have a podcast episode specifically on circuses and zoos. I guess I just feel like it's so obvious, but it's not to everybody. And I want to be able to speak to some of the, you know, some of the kind of marketing and PR that we hear around, especially zoos, where they talk about conservation and we need zoos because of conservation, et cetera. So I will talk about, and I do consider that entertainment, by the way. I do consider zoos entertainment. I don't consider them outside of that category, like with circuses and traveling shows, et cetera. So we'll talk more about that. But today, I want to talk specifically about animals in film and the history behind the American Humane Association and its disclaimer. Any regular film goer is familiar with a disclaimer at the end of most films, especially films that have any kind of animals in them. And that includes insects, by the way. I mean, even an animal that has insects being used, I mean, because usually they're leased by a private owner, then the American Humane Association is on that set. And you're familiar with that disclaimer at the end of the film that says no animals were harmed in the making of this film. This message is given with the approval of the American Humane Association, which has oversight over the treatment of animals in films. They actually own the trademark of that phrase, no animals were harmed. So as you might imagine, whenever an organization has oversight over filmmakers or any private industry, there was probably some incident or legal ruling that led them to gain that oversight. In other words, companies typically don't volunteer to be overseen by an outside group. So how did the filmmakers of the United States come to agree to have their treatment of animals overseen by the American Humane Association, like legitimately and officially? Very sadly, it culminated with a horse being pushed off of a 75-foot high cliff. So we'll come back to that. The movie industry began in the 1890s, as you know, when motion picture cameras were invented and film production companies started to be established. But the movie industry really begins to take off in the 1920s, and westerns and war films became more and more popular, which meant, of course, that horses were used for battle scenes with no regard for the horses themselves. There were basically no regulations at all. There were no laws, nothing that protected the animals who were used on film or TV sets. They were just considered props, you know, that were disposable and replaceable. In westerns and war pictures, of course, filmmakers want to create verisimilitude. They still do, in terms of showing horses dropping as if shot by guns or arrows. One of the techniques that filmmakers used then was called the running W, and it was used for making horses fall by way of tripwires. So the running W was the actual device and the technique of these tripwires. These tripwires couldn't be detected by the audience. You still can't really tell, but they were devised to tangle horses and make them fall, sometimes while at full gallop. From the book, which I own here, which is really something I recommend, called Mustang, The Saga of the Wild Horse in the American West, I'll read a quote from that. It was named for an old range method of breaking wild horses in which they were tied to a moving wagon with a long rope. If they fought the line or tried to run in a different direction, the moving wagon simply pulled them down. In the movies, the practice was modified and became deadlier. Piano wire was attached to a horse's front legs with a leather strop and then run up through a cinch on the saddle horn where it was secured. The other end of the wire was connected to a buried stake. On cue, the horse would begin to run, and the rider would jump just before the wire ran out, and the horse took a hard and often fatal fall. In the 1925 version of Ben-Hur, up to 100 horses were killed during the chariot race. It was not regulated at all. Up to 100 horses were killed. Now, they were killed either outright from this fall, they broke their necks, or they broke their limbs and were shot afterwards. It was directed, this particular scene, the chariot race, was directed by second unit director B. Reeves Easton, E-A-S-O-N. I've seen it spelled E-A-S-T-O-N, like Easton, but I'm pretty certain it's Easton, who had a reputation for lax on-set safety. To boot, a stuntman was also killed during the filming of that chariot race, and so it probably won't come as a surprise to hear that Easton was the man responsible for the horses and another stuntman killed in the 1936 film, The Charge of the Light Brigade. For the filming of that climactic charge, 125 horses were tripwired. 125 horses were tripwired. And of these, 25 were killed outright or had to be put down afterwards. A man named Jack Montgomery, who worked on this film as a stuntman, is quoted as saying, "I never saw so many good men and horses smashed up in one day in all my years in the picture business. I've always thought those Humane Society people," it's not Humane Society, it's the American Humane Association, but he said, "I've always thought those Humane Society people with their reps snooping around on every set or location were a bunch of busybodies, but by God, today every cowboy on the set stood behind the rep when he set up a howl." So, you know, this isn't just like, oh, this happened a long time ago and that was acceptable then and now it's something we look down upon. It was unacceptable to many people at that time, but there were no laws in place. Errol Flynn, who was the star of the film, The Charge of the Light Brigade, in 1936, and I have to just say, I love Errol Flynn. If you haven't seen any Errol Flynn movies, like Robin Hood, for instance, you have to see him. He is so incredibly charismatic, and of course, he had a reputation in Hollywood for being probably too charismatic because he had many, many affairs with many, many women, and he was quite the player. But I just enjoy watching him so much. He is so incredibly full of personality and charisma, and I always loved him. But I loved him a little more after reading about his response to the tripwires used in the film, The Charge of the Light Brigade, and apparently he really had a hard time with the entire process and had a lot of fights with the director because of it. And in fact, in his autobiography, he writes about it. His autobiography is called My Wicked, Wicked Ways, which is not surprising. And he's quoted as talking about these tripwires. Horses, quote, have been perhaps the most badly treated animals in the motion picture industry, especially in the days when these early Westerns were being ground out. A device called the Running W was used on horses, a tripwire, to make the animals tumble at the right instant. The stuntman riding the horse knew where the tripwire was. He knew when he had to get off, and all he had to do was take a fall. But the horse would go head first and sometimes get hurt and have to be shot. They eventually stopped this because so many horses broke their legs and their necks, and there were protests by the actors and the public. But sadly, it would still be years and many injuries and many deaths later before the Running W was banned and any serious protections were put in place for animals on movie and TV sets, despite the fact that the American Humane Association was already monitoring the situation. So just be really clear that the American Humane Association was already there on set. They just weren't there officially. So as you've heard me talk about in previous episodes, a lot of the early animal welfare groups were formed by individuals who took on the mistreatment of farm animals early on. The current climate in which organizations are, you know, trying to put animal welfare laws and trying to protect farmed animals in place is part of a very long legacy, and the American Humane Association is no different. It was formed in 1877 when 27 animal welfare organizations formed to discuss the mistreatment of animals during their transport transport between the eastern and western U.S. That's 1877. In 1954, obviously I'm jumping ahead because I wanted to stay on topic of our purpose today, which is about their role in films. In 1954, there was a split among the leadership, and many of the core group splintered off to found what you now know as the Humane Society of the United States. And by then, also by 1954, when there was the split between the Humane Society and the American Humane Association, by 1954, their committee to investigate cruelties in the training of animals for the movies was also established by then. It was set up as early as 1925, but nothing was substantially done until more animals were killed and abused on sets. 1939 seems to be a particularly bad year for animals in the movies. In John Ford's Stagecoach, tripwires were used and many, many horses were killed or killed later because of injuries. And I do think there's a stuntman who was really well known for using these. And this is really heartbreaking because otherwise, Stagecoach is an amazing film. It's an incredible movie, and it's the one that put John Wayne on the map, and it started this long, fruitful, creative relationship between John Ford and John Wayne. So, of course, it's heartbreaking. And, of course, when I saw it, I knew it was awful for the horses. And I'll talk more about my reaction to these films in watching them toward the end of the podcast episode. So, Stagecoach, that was 1939. A lot of tripwires, a lot of animals hurt. In Renoir's 1939 film, The Rules of the Game, which is also a fine film otherwise. I do like Renoir films. He used real rabbits for the hunting scenes. And again, when I saw this film, I didn't know before I saw the film that a rabbit would have been shot for real in this 1939 film. But I was concerned. I saw it and I was like, oh my God, it looks like that rabbit was killed. But you kind of look at it and go, no, that's not, they couldn't have done that. You just can't believe that they did it. But they did it. And otherwise, it's a good film. And I've actually considered putting it on my list of animal consciousness films in the sense that it shows the ridiculousness of hunting, especially among the upper classes. So there were other takeaways for me from that film. But of course, one of them was, oh my God, you shot a rabbit for real on film. And that's like a snuff film, in my opinion, because when you're showing any kind of killing for real, that crosses the line, in my opinion. But it was the 1939 film Jesse James that changed things. So the film starred Tyrone Power as Jesse James and Henry Fonda as his brother Frank James, and it was directed by Henry King. Incidentally, I'm also a fan of both Tyrone Power and Henry Fonda for many films, but both of them are in films that are also on my list of films that have some animal consciousness in them, and I want to name them here because we're talking about film, and I want you to take a pen and paper and write this down. There was a 1947 film called Nightmare Alley starring Tyrone Power, and it was really dark. And even I think his agent didn't want him to do this film because he had never done such a dark film. And he was really a very well-known, sex symbol, and they didn't really want him to do something that was so distorted and dark. He plays an alcoholic. He's at this freak show. It's really amazing. But there's a lot in there I found about animals. Now, one of the characters, so please don't get me wrong, one of the characters is someone who in those freak shows, I forgot what's the name of those people who do it. They bite the heads off of chickens. No chicken, like his head wasn't bit off, like it didn't happen in the film. But that was one of the characters, the geek, where he was, they're called geeks. That's the origin of the word geek. So they were people who in these freak shows would bite the heads off of chickens as part of the entertainment. So anyway, it's an amazing film. I love it. Tyrone Power. So love him in that. And then, of course, Henry Fonda. Love Henry Fonda for so many films. But there's another film of his that I put on my animal consciousness list, and it's a Fritz Lang film called You Only Live Once. It's from 1937. And there's a couple throwaway lines in there, but there are some lines that really I found really powerful, and they go on my list. Not the whole film. It's not the whole character or the whole film itself, but a couple lines. One having to do with someone who's being executed in prison, and he asks for his last meal to be like a chicken or something like that, chicken dish. And the cook in the kitchen says something like, just reflecting on this, says something like, "We kill the chicken, and then we kill him." Like, doesn't make any sense. Like, just makes this connection between the violence against the chicken and violence against the person who's about to be executed. It was really powerful for a 1937. Well, it's a powerful anyway, and it was made in 1937 by Fritz Lang. No surprise. Fritz Lang is amazing. Okay. I wanted to tell you those things because it's related. But I was disappointed to realize that King, Henry King, was the director of Jesse James, because I've seen and really love a few of his films. And of course, the truth is all of these guys were operating under no standards for animals. So on one hand, it really was part of the acceptable climate. But on the other hand, like I said, people were on these sets seeing what was happening, and they were definitely bothered by the kinds of things they were seeing. In the case of Jesse James, a horse was essentially forced to run off of a cliff and plunge to his death in the river below. His spine was broken, and then he was shot. Off camera, he was shot. The stunt remains in the film. And if you watch it, and by the way, you can watch all of the clips that I'm going to be talking about and or see a still photo at joyfulvegan.com on the page for today's episode. So please note that you have the option of watching these or not. They will not play automatically if you go to the page for today's episode. They do not play automatically because some of the things are just, you know, upsetting to see, some worse than others. And I didn't include some that were just, I think, horrific, and I don't include them on the page. But you can also see a still. So I do invite you to go over there so you can see a visual image, and you don't have to watch the whole film. Obviously, it's just a clip of what you'll see, and then you'll see a still also. You'll see two horses being ridden off the cliff along with their riders, but actually just note that in this case, the second was actually just a closer camera angle of the first. They had set it up so that one horse is being thrown off, you know, the cliff, jumping off the cliff, looks like he's just jumping off the cliff, and they shot it from two different angles, and so that they, when they actually edited the film, they made it look like there were two riders and two horses, because it was both Frank and Jesse who were jumping off this cliff. They were, you know, being chased by the law. But a horse, which is enough, in my opinion, to be upsetting, a horse was forced to jump off this cliff and he died. And the death of this horse led to such outrage and protests that the Motion Picture Association of America finally agreed to let the AHA establish guidelines for the use of animals in films and oversee filming to ensure compliance. So this was a landmark moment, because like I said, the AHA had been on film sets unofficially, you know, watching things since 1925. And it wasn't until 1939 that it became official. So probably officially in 1940 is when it happened. Now, of course, this wasn't out of the goodness of their hearts, because they cared so much about the animals, the Motion Picture Association of America. They were trying to avoid litigation and legislation, because by now the U.S. Congress was being pulled in. As I said earlier, as we know, one of the things private industries are most afraid of is government regulation. So rather than let Congress get involved, the Motion Picture Association of America agreed to let the American Humane Association oversee the treatment of animals in their films from that point on. So the American Humane Association set up a Hollywood office in 1940, and they began officially monitoring the treatment of animals in films. They created a set of rules that filmmakers had to adhere to, and a group of overseers who were allowed to be present on all film and TV sets. The problem was that the jurisdiction was given to them by the Hays Office. And if you don't know what the Hays Office was, I really encourage you to read more about this time in American history. It was a very dark time in American history, dark time in the film arts, in my opinion, a very dark time for free speech. The Hays Office was an organization that promulgated a moral code for films. In 1922, after a number of scandals involving like Hollywood personalities, film industry leaders formed this organization to counteract the threat of government censorship and to create favorable publicity for the industry. And so under Will H. Hays, a politically active lawyer, the Hays Office initiated a blacklist. They inserted morals clauses into actors' contracts. And in 1930, they developed the production code, which detailed what was morally acceptable on the screen. It's known as the code. We talk about it as the code era. The code was supplanted in 1966 by a voluntary rating system, which we know today, which has its own problems, but that's another story. But so for all of those years, this code existed. It became known as the Hays Code after the lawyer who started it. But from 1934 to 1954, the code was closely identified with and enforced by Joseph Breen. He was the administrator appointed by Hays to enforce the code in Hollywood. So I encourage you to look it up online for the full list of this code. There's a list called don'ts and be carefuls, and I'm going to read a couple of you. So there's a list of, I'm laughing, but it's so awful. It's just so awful, but the title just makes me laugh. Don'ts and be carefuls. Those things which are included in the following list shall not appear in pictures produced by the members of this association, irrespective of the manner in which they are treated. Here are just a few. You can go see these online. So not allowed. Pointed profanity by either title or lip. This includes the words God, Lord, Jesus, Christ, unless they be used reverently in connection with proper religious ceremonies. Hell, damn, God, G-A-W-D, and every other profane and vulgar expression, however it may be spelled. I'm laughing, right? I love that. Every other profane and vulgar expression, however you might spell it. You could spell it a different way and it's still not going to be acceptable. Not allowed. Any licentious or suggestive nudity. In fact, or in silhouette, and any lecherous or licentious notice thereof by other characters in the picture. Not allowed. Miscegenation. Miscegenation was sex relationships between white and black. The way it's phrased here, sex relationships between the white and black races is how they phrased it. So that was forbidden. Not allowed. Sex hygiene and venereal diseases. Not allowed. Scenes of actual childbirth, in fact or in silhouette. Not allowed. Ridicule of the clergy. There were so many don'ts and be carefuls. And then there's this huge list of how things can be characterized on film, like massive. And some restrictions, such as the ban on homosexuality, was never directly mentioned, but it was assumed to be understood. And so in many films during the code era, a lot of filmmakers use subversive tactics to suggest homosexuality without directly showing it. There's a really wonderful documentary called The Celluloid Closet, and it's a documentary that interviews various men and women connected to Hollywood, and they comment on the various film clips and in their own personal experiences with the treatment of LGBT characters on film. And it's really interesting, really, really interesting. So I recommend checking out The Celluloid Closet. But more than that, a number of films were influenced by this censorship. And you can, again, read all about this. Many films weren't made because of this censorship. The only good thing that came out of it was that kind of cleverness and subversiveness that you can see filmmakers trying to get around these rules, especially as time was going on. And I know there was a I feel like there was a documentary on that. I guess it was Celluloid Closet, which I would watch that. But when you watch films from like the 40s, like post-code, in fact, we do a lot of film festivals where there's like pre-code and post-code films. And some films were remade in the post-code era, like, or in the code era. So there's like, you can watch these films as pre-code films, which were really racy and like, you know, I don't know, authentic. They were about, you know, there were sexual relations and women were sexual and they weren't just these objects, which is how they became kind of portrayed as time went on once the code was in place. They were a lot more courageous in these films and in these stories and in these characters. But after the code's in place, after 1930, you can just see there's a tightening of creativity, frankly, and it affected many, many films. But you also get to see some of these films where there's a suggestion of sexuality or relationships. And there are some that are just like, oh my gosh, I can't believe they even got away with that. But they did. And one of them is The Big Combo, which is a film noir that I absolutely love. And I recommend watching it. I'm not going to say anymore because I know we have lots of age groups on this podcast. But The Big Combo is a wonderful film anyway. It's a wonderful film noir that I encourage you to watch. And I think you'll see the scene I'm talking about when it's so suggestive, but they never show it, which makes it even more intriguing, I think. And then you just think, oh my God, how did they get away with that? And I did watch the behind the scenes about that movie and about that one scene, and they talk about how they get away with it. So I'll leave you with that little seed planted called The Big Combo. So it's a fascinating bit of history, and I really recommend that you read more about it if you don't know a lot about it. But the reason I bring all this up, you're like, why are you talking about all this? What happened to the animals in film? The reason I bring all this up is because the AHA, the American Humane Association, was aligned with the Hays office for years. It was given its official jurisdiction by the Hays office. But in 1966, the Supreme Court disbanded the Hays office, which was good in general in terms of loosening all the censorship that plagued filmmakers. But it was bad for the animals in that the American Humane Association's film and TV unit lost its right to access sets. So it's a stupid loophole. I think it's a dumb loophole. I also think the problem is that the American Humane Association probably shouldn't have been so closely linked to the film industry because, of course, there's conflicts of interest, and we'll get to that in part two. But despite its efforts to oversee productions, the American Humane Association was often banned from sets. And incidents of abuse and injury and fatalities to animals used in movies and television escalated in a big way, in a really big way. Unfortunately, there are many, many examples. So remember, this is after 1966. So a lot of this loosening of rules to protect animals came after 1966, even though the AHA would be on some film sets, but officially they didn't have an official capacity. And in many film sets, they were banned. So as I said, there are many examples of incidents, but here are a few famous, here are a few notorious ones. Now, I'm going to give you all a warning right now. I think everything I've said up to this point is upsetting, but it's not necessarily something I would have warned you about. A horse being thrown off a cliff is awful, but I really want to give you a warning that if you don't want to hear what I'm going to say here, and I'm being mindful of my audience still, I'm not going to make it difficult for you to hear, but I want to tell you what happens. And in order to do that, it just might be a little disturbing. So I'm giving you a warning right now. You can shut it down and, you know, come back. I'll just tell you this. The first one is really disturbing. So there's a 1972 film called Pink Flamingos, which is by John Waters. So you won't be surprised that it's weird and perverted, but it's basically, in my opinion, I don't know, I think it's just a snuff film because again, an animal is killed for the making of this scene. And you can, no, actually, I told my assistant to please take that clip off of my site. You can go find it if you want to, but I am not including an image or the clip on the joyfulvegan.com website. I'm just not doing it. So you can go find it somewhere else if you really want to, but I think it's so depraved that I didn't want to include it on my site. So chickens are basically used as sex toys, and they're smashed between bodies during a sex scene. And one chicken in particular was killed by this scene, and then his blood is all over their bodies, and that's part of the whole scene. And worse is that, I don't know, John Waters, who I generally find to be a thoughtful, intelligent person, not thoughtful in this way, but intelligent at least. I'm not a fan of his films, but I've listened to many interviews with him and I've read many interviews with him and I find him an interesting person. I just don't like his films at all. But he defended this scene by saying that the chicken was destined for slaughter anyway, and they ate the chicken afterwards as if that's okay. And so it's very disturbing. Yuck. That was 1973. Also in 1973 is a film by Sam Peckinpah called Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. Now, I actually know this film and like this film a lot. I really love Sam Peckinpah, which might surprise some of you who know that Sam Peckinpah made a lot of, and there's a lot of darkness and violence in Sam Peckinpah's films, but I find his subjects very interesting. And when I first saw it, I was definitely disturbed by what looked like actual violence against animals. So you can turn the volume down if you want to just wait a second. And I've since confirmed that it was indeed the case. Peckinpah is known for violence in his films, you know, against people, but no person is actually getting shot. And this one's no exception. The Wild Bunch is another film that I really love. But don't watch it if you don't like violence in films, you know, just a shooting or anything in films. But I do think it's an amazing film. But there's also animal violence in The Wild Bunch, which turned out to be real. I think a scorpion was dropped into this big colony of ants who just ate this scorpion alive. I mean, he was, you know, a living scorpion. And then in Pat Garrett, so please turn the volume down. A couple chickens were buried up to their necks. Their eyes were doused with lighter fluid, and they were the targets for a couple of characters who were using them for target practice, and so their heads were shot off. My understanding is that they weren't actually shot, that they used explosives to have the heads fly off. So awful, horrific, disgusting, despicable. When I watched the film, I did not know that that was in the film. Watched it and was like, no, they can't have done that. There's no way. I know the American Humane Association would have been there on the set. You know, so there was a lot to know. This was several years ago that I saw the film. I didn't know by then they really didn't have any jurisdiction. And so, you know, it's a disturbing scene. But the rest of the movie as a whole, I think it's a really good film. There's such a beautiful moment at the end of the film where Bob Dylan's Knocking on Heaven's Doors is in it. It's a, you know, his song, and Bob Dylan was in the film. So anyway, so that was 1973. In 1979, famously in At the End of Apocalypse Now, which is also an incredible in every other way film, But in this movie, Francis Ford Coppola decides to film a water buffalo being killed through a ritual sacrifice, and he's basically hacked to death with machetes. And his justification was the same as John Waters, even though I do think it's a little different. So Coppola's justification was that the off camera, this tribe was going to be killing this water buffalo anyway, and so they just filmed it. I do think it's a little different than John Waters getting a chicken who was going to be killed for the film. That is different, in my opinion, and then torturing this chicken and then crushing him between two bodies. But if you use the same argument for a human being, it wouldn't fly. Like if you said, well, someone's going to be executed, they're going to be executed anyway, you know, by electric chair or lethal injection, and I'm just going to film it because, you know, it's happening anyway, but I'm just going to film it. Now, that's called a snuff film. It's called Faces of Death, and it wouldn't fly. So, okay, you know, he's going to justify it. It's going to happen anyway. They're there filming. He shoots this buffalo being, you know, being killed. You decide for yourself. Again, in every other way, I think the movie is really an important commentary on war, and it's beautifully made in every other way. But, you know, of course, I don't like that scene. Heaven's Gate, though, in 1980, was the film that changed everything again. So Heaven's Gate was made by Michael Cimino, and he's most known and appreciated for his film The Deer Hunter, which is also an incredible film and one that makes my list of movies with animal consciousness because of the main character and what happens to him when he comes back from experiencing Vietnam. You know, of course, they're in like rural Pennsylvania, I think it is, and they were hunters before the war, and then they go through all this violence in war, and they come back, and he goes on the hunt again, and he decides not to shoot this buck that he sees. And there's a clear connection between what he experienced in Vietnam and what he's seeing this deer deserve life in the woods in Pennsylvania. And so it's a very powerful movie in many, many ways, again, specifically about war and then making that connection between violence against animals and violence against people, I find really moving. And that was Michael Cimino, I don't care because I hate what he did in Heaven's Gate. So Heaven's Gate was so rife with egregious and unnecessary animal abuse and deaths that it led to changes for animals on film sets once again. Now I've seen Heaven's Gate. And if you haven't seen it, you may have at least heard of it because it's notorious. It is the film that is probably considered the biggest box office flop in history. It's been called the worst film ever, and it was responsible for the near collapse of United Artists Studios. United Artists was famously founded in 1919 by D.W. Griffith, Charlie Chaplin, Mary Pickford, and Douglas Fairbanks. And the film itself was a box office disaster, and Cimino seems to have suffered from huge head syndrome because he just kept doing exactly what he wanted, and he just kept getting more and more money from the studio, and just they kept sinking more and more money, millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars into this film, and it almost bankrupt the studio. I mean, it was virtually bankrupt. So that's kind of like all of the legends surrounding Heaven's Gate. There's so many stories about Heaven's Gate. Now it's being viewed in a different light, especially the edit that's closer to what Cimino intended, because that's also a big part of the story, is that his edit like originally was like 9 hours long. I mean, something ridiculous. And then the studios get it and they chop it down, and he's just horrified by what they did. And then they released that version, and it's a very interesting story. And I don't think it's one of the worst films ever made, but I don't think it's great. And I did see it because I was interested in seeing it because of its reputation. David and I were like, all right, we've got to see Heaven's Gate. Like, what's the deal? We wanted to know what all the fuss was about. But again, at the time, I didn't know about the animal cruelty, which resulted in 4 dead horses, disemboweled cows, and unsimulated, i.e. real cockfights. So not known for listening to anyone ever, Cimino refused to allow the American Humane Association on the set. Even going so far, apparently, there's a story that the AHA reps were barred at gunpoint from the Heaven's Gate set in Montana's Glacier National Park. They were being stopped from going onto the property at gunpoint. I believe it. If you know anything about this film and the making of it, I believe it. So the AHA picketed screenings of the films, and there was a public outcry, which resulted in the film industry reinstating the American Humane Association's authority to protect animals on set. So there's a contract in place that says any film that involves animals, like contractually speaking, the American Humane Association must be on set. So even though they were regranted official jurisdiction over film sets in 1980, it was in 1972, just for your awareness that the American Humane Association's first No Animals Were Harmed end credit was issued to a movie, and that movie was called The Doberman Gang. That was in 1972. So there's a little bit of trivia for you if you ever have a trivia game and someone asks, what's the first film that had the No Animals Were Harmed credit? It was a 1972 film called The Doberman Gang, which looks really stupid. It looks like some people like made these Dobermans rob a bank. I don't know. I'm not going to see it, but that's the movie, 1972. Doberman Gang, but it was in 1980 that they got official jurisdiction over film sets. And that brings us to the end of part one, because I think this is such a big topic. And I wanted to talk about first, what were the films that started this? How did the American Humane Association even get onto these sets? There's so much more to talk about, and I'm really looking forward to talking about what comes next. I want to just briefly answer, some of you have asked me how I could watch films where animal abuse takes place, or even where animals were used in films. Some people don't believe that animals, you know, have a place in films at all. And of course, I talk about this in White God. So I want to speak to that. You know, if we watch these old films where animals were used and abused and exploited, aren't we somehow contributing to cruelty to animals? People have asked me. I don't necessarily think that's the case. I don't think that my watching a Western from 1950 or a war film from 1970 that of course included horses, whether or not the horses were properly protected or not, that I'm contributing to animal exploitation. And where animal cruelty took place, not only does it make me more informed to be able to speak to that film and to the issues in that film, many times I didn't even know when I watched these films. But as a fan of films, I do tend to watch everything that a director did if I like that director. So once I discovered Peckinpah, that was an example where, yeah, I wanted to watch The Wild Bunch and I wanted to watch Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. And like I said, it has Bob Dylan in it and they have this beautiful scene with Knocking on Heaven's Door. So I still think it was a good film. But me not watching that film, I don't think helps animals. My bearing witness in this case, I think, could help. So that's how I am able to do it. Now, you may be different. I'm very interested in what makes humans tick. I'm very interested in what makes humans violent and what makes them fight for justice. And of course, you know, films are just kind of one medium in which we can understand this and kind of play with these ideas of who we are. And I'm very interested in stories about this, about how people behave when there is no law or justice, which is why I like Westerns, which is why I like war films. You know, most Westerns don't glorify, and even war films, like the good ones, they don't glorify violence. They show the consequences of it. That's what's so amazing about the good films about war or the good Westerns. Many old Westerns, like those of John Ford, many of which he made with John Wayne, show the strength of friendships and family and camaraderie and male friendships. And they're so much more complex than I thought they would be before I started watching them. Same with war pictures. They're not just jingoistic celebrations of violence. They're complex. They show the horrors of war. They show the horrors of the effects of killing on the people who kill. And many of these films also show the effects of killing animals. Like that's part of these films as well. And that's what I get out of them that I think is so beneficial in terms of shaping who I am and how I see the world and what I'm able to pass on to you. So I find that really valuable. That doesn't mean that violence against animals on screen doesn't bother me. Of course it does. And like I said, there are films that I've turned off and there are films that I would never watch. But for the most part, when it happens so quickly, all of a sudden you're like, wait, no, that's not, oh my God, that's awful. That can't be real. That was so awful. And then the next scene's on and you watch the rest of the film. That doesn't mean I forget about the animals. It just means there's more to the film than just that scene. I hope that makes sense. You know, that might not work for you at all. It makes me sick to know that animals were treated in any way that where they were harmed, but I'd be lying if I said that it means I hate the entire movie because of it. Now, all of that's to say, I do draw a line. I do think it's possible to have animals in film who are taken care of and not hurt. Listen to my White Guide episode. But that only applies to domesticated animals. I would never, ever, ever watch well or support a movie that trained wild animals. I corrected myself because I watched like, you know, Bringing Up Baby that was made in the 40s with Katharine Hepburn and Cary Grant. Yeah, I like watched it, but I actually don't even think I watched the whole thing. It's about a tiger. I think it's a tiger they have who's called Baby. And they kidnap the tiger from a museum. I can't remember what happened, but they have this tiger. And of course, this tiger is obviously, I am certain, abused off screen, you know, for this film. And I was disgusted and I don't think I finished it. But where there are wild animals involved in films at all, I do not support them, period. There's no ands, ifs, or buts about it. But do I feel the same way when like a dog is the star of a film, like, or a co-star, or he steals the show, like in the case of The Dog and the Artist, the movie that won the Academy Award a few years ago? No, I do believe that he was well-loved and cared for by his person. I do not feel that that dog was abused. I don't. Some people are going to feel like, well, no, any dog, any animal in any movie that's bad, okay, that's your prerogative. But I feel that way about chimpanzees and bobcats and wolves or any wild animals at all. So those are some of the questions we're going to talk more about in part two, right? So, okay, if you think that it's okay to have dogs on set, well, what are the standards that the American Humane Association are setting? Like, what are these standards? Are they high enough to make sure that the animals aren't harmed, whether they're domesticated or insects, right? I mean, like, what are these standards? Are there cases where films got the stamp of approval from the American Humane Association that turned out to actually have harmed animals? Then that includes domesticated animals. I'm not naive. I'm not stupid. I'm not saying that it's foolproof, but because there are plenty of stories of even dogs and cats and, of course, farmed animals who were used on sets where there was abuse and there were deaths, and the American Humane Association gave their stamp of approval. Is there a conflict of interest where an overseer is actually funded by the very industry it's monitoring? So, maybe. And what other systems are in place to protect animals on film and on TV sets? And what can the public do about its concern about animals on film and TV sets? And that's a big one, right? Because these, you know, once a movie's made, it's really tough to do anything. Now, what's exciting is that because I think there's so much more exposure to things and so quickly to the public, we are hearing about things that were happening on sets, but mostly in the case of television shows, because they're still being made. So the most infamous and successful of which, in terms of success, in terms of shutting it down, was Luck. And we'll talk about that in part two. That was an HBO show, which unfortunately was made by the guy who did Deadwood, because that was such a brilliant TV series. But he was making this show called Luck, which was about horse racing. And the word got out that horses were dying because they were just being, you know, overrun. And it's horse racing, which is awful. And so it was shut down. Now, that was possible to do because it was a television show that's ongoing. Movies are a little harder. By the time the word gets out to the public, the movie's been made, and okay, what do we do now? So we're going to talk about some of that in part two and what we can do to be part of the solution to make sure that we are protecting animals on film sets, including dogs, including cats, including the animals, like I said, the domesticated animals. And I want to be clear. I'm not saying that I love films. I think all films should have dogs and cats and it's okay. I'm saying that I think it can be done, but it has to be under a rigorous, rigorous system with really, really good intentions. That's what I'm saying. I'm saying that not every single time a dog is used, or like in The Artist, that there's abuse. But I do think that if we're going to have animals on film and TV sets, which we do, we're there, we have to make sure that systems are in place to protect them. And so what are the things that we can do to make sure of that? So we're going to cover all of that in part two, might be part two and three, of Animals in Film. And if you'd like to join me, I mentioned in the beginning of the podcast, we are going to be going on that European river cruise. I'm not a big cruise person, but this is a river cruise. There's like 100 people on the boat. It's a small boat. It's on the Danube. It goes through Germany and Austria, and it ends up in Hungary. And we're going to have New Year's Eve on the boat. Well, in Austria, like New Year's Eve. I have always wanted to be in like old Europe for New Year's Eve, and we're going to be there. So we decided to go, and this might be also a trip that we're going to do as a travel with CPG trip, and I'm really excited about it. So if you're interested, there are still spaces available, and it's pretty affordable. I'm really impressed whether you're in Europe or not. It's a pretty affordable price, and again, you'll be in Austria for New Year's, and we'll be celebrating New Year's together, all vegan food, all vegans. I imagine it's going to be pretty much packed with vegans, and I think it'd be a really fun trip. So veganrivercruises.com. I will be there, and let me know if you're interested too. And if you're also interested, follow me on Periscope, because I think we can talk about this issue more together, this issue of animals in film. So for the animals, this is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau. Thank you for listening.